Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Moran here from Tom's Big Spider. So to kick this one off, we're going to get this out of the way because I did say this would be more upbeat this week. Unfortunately, the Queen has passed away. I arrived home from work the other day and was up in the Tarantula Room, which is usually my first place I go to when I get home. And I was setting up the table to do some recording, and I looked over at her enclosure, and she was actually not in the corner. She had basically been all scrunched up in like a stress pose, almost looking like it was going to lead toward a death curl, which I had this thing about her. Like, I did not want to see her in a death curl. I'd had the spider for so long. I loathed seeing any spider in a death curl. I didn't want to see her in a death curl. And that's where she looked like she was heading towards. And I looked over, and she was sitting perched, like, kind of right in the middle of her enclosure, spread out, looking rather good and healthy. And I got excited for a second and was like, oh, man, maybe she's coming out of this. Maybe I was completely wrong. Maybe she'll want something to eat. And I think I kind of knew in my heart that wasn't the case, but it did look promising. And so I walked over to the enclosure, picked it up, and brought it over to the table. I opened the top while between picking up the enclosure and walking over. She didn't budge at all. She never moved. And so I opened it up, and I just kind of stuck my hand in and gently tapped her back leg, and she was definitely not with us anymore. So, you know, again, I knew it was coming. Last week was kind of the beginning of the end where I recognized and kind of allowed myself to accept the fact that she wasn't going to be here. And I don't want to make it overly dramatic, but it's a spider that's been with me for a very long time. You know, doing this Tom's Big Spider stuff for many, many years, there'd be none of it without that spider. It's what you can trace it right down to her. I can trace my obsession with the hobby down to that very moment that Billy and I were sitting there on the couch talking about how depressing it would be when she goes, because we'd had her for so long at that point, and that was years ago. And I can remember jumping on the computer and finding out there's this whole world of tarantulas out there, finding out that although I'm in Connecticut and I can't buy anything in person, I do not have to jump over to Massachusetts to buy tarantulas. I could buy them online. It was like a huge, like, eye-opening experience all because of her. And then over the years, obviously, she's become like the jewel of my collection. I've said many times when people ask you that, you know, when you play the game, what tarantula would you keep if you'd only keep one? I've said many, many times it would be her without a doubt. That'd be like, if that was it, if somebody said that's it, you can only keep one, it would have been her. So really important spider as far as, you know, especially if anybody that appreciates the stuff I'm doing, enjoys the stuff I'm doing, it's kind of neat to think it all started with that one little spider, which, you know, I was explaining to somebody the other day, I rarely get upset at anything. Like, I've discussed things, I've had differing opinions with people over the years. I learn from listening to other opinions. I'm of the mind that when somebody has a totally different opinion, you should shut your mouth and listen to it and try to understand where they're coming from. Sometimes you're never going to see eye to eye. Other times you're going to hear the stuff that they say, and it's going to change your way of looking at things. And I think, you know, over the years, I've had situations where somebody said something and I've been like, nah, no way, man. But I've heard them out, and it's allowed me to make changes in my husbandry. It's allowed me to see things with a different perspective. The one that always irritates me, and I know because it's my personal, you know, opinion about the spider, is when it became very popular to bash G. porteri, G. rosea, as beginner species, where it's suddenly the in vogue. And again, I think there was a realization at some point that there are better tarantulas out there to start with. That's an undeniable fact. There's ones that are a little more predictable as far as temperament, because we always talk about psycho rosies, where you either have a rose hair that's really laid back or one that's a little bit crazy. The fasting drives people absolutely nuts. And again, I do think a lot of that could be attributed back to the day that they were pulled out of the wild and their internal clocks were messed up, so they were fasting because they were expecting it to be winter. But whatever, I totally get that they're not the best. But it became the new thing for a little while for people that were just getting into the hobby to turn around and do videos and talk about how terrible beginner species they are. And that's bull. I remember one in particular where somebody made the comment that if these were the only beginner species in the hobby, so many people wouldn't be in the hobby. They're a terrible beginner species. They're going to drive people away from the hobby because they're so boring. And yet here I am, somebody that started first tarantula was a G. porteri, the rose hair. We called her the Rosie for years, a little fact that Billy brought up the other day, that for years she was just the Rosie. I didn't even know the name for it. I didn't know the scientific name. But she kicked all of this off, and I've spoken to many other keepers that have been around for a little while, and a lot of them started with G. porteri, and a lot of them say the same thing. At that point, when you're keeping a tarantula, you don't care so much that it's, you know, I've heard the discussion, they're ugly, whatever, they're brown, they're not very vibrant. you're keeping a giant spider. Like, that was one of the most popular. I kept at one point 40 snakes. And the thing everybody asked to see, you come out, they'd look at the snakes. They'd be like, you know, I'd take the boas out and show the boas. I'd take some of the corn snakes out. We'd, you know, everybody would, oh, these are awesome. Can we see the spider? Can we see the spider? It was all the same. Everybody wanted to see the spider. So that was one of the big things that drove me nuts when people started bashing that particular species because of how much the spider meant to me and how much the spider meant to, like, what I do now in the hobby. It's all because of her. It all started with that one little spider. So, I'll be doing a video of it, and I'm trying to put something together where I got some older clips of her and stuff, because basically I came home, found her, whipped out my camera. I had to do something. Like, this spider is huge. I talked about maybe possibly adding her to the Tom's Big Spiders logo, so instead of the silhouetted tarantula in the background, maybe we'll have the queen. We'll see about dabbling in something like that, because it seems like, again, when I started doing this stuff years ago, I never expected it to go anywhere. We were joking. I was explaining to a teacher the other day because I made a joke in class about pets, and I said I had, you know, 4 dogs, a couple snakes, and 220 tarantulas, and she laughed, and we moved on with the conversation. And then later on, she came back. She's like, "That's funny. You're joking, right?" And so I got a little bit into telling her about, you know, not only do I keep them, but I geeked out and started doing a blog years ago, which was, again, a totally kind of a joke. I was just trying to get it out of my system and write stuff. I never thought in a million years anybody was ever going to read anything I put out there. For a while, we would sit down and, you know, watch TV, and I'd go and check the stats on my blog. I'm like, oh, I got a view today. This is amazing. And then I got 3 views. And I remember one time it was like, I might hit 10 views today. And I walk out in the other room, and I've got my daughter on her Kindle and Billy on the computer, basically refreshing to make it look like people are watching it. And I'm like, oh, thanks, guys. But then it found an audience. And now, you know, how many years later, here we are with the podcast, with the YouTube, with, I do got to go back and do articles. I know that's my big thing, but the website is still going strong, and it's all because of a little G-Port Terry. So that'll be all we talk about today. Again, I think it's a good thing. I wanted to put a positive spin on it. It's a bummer, and I've had time, obviously, to think it over. As far as people have asked me what I was going to do, I mentioned that I might, put on epoxy or do something with her, where you preserve her so that you can see her, whatever it is. And, the more I thought about it, the more that's just not what I want to do. I think for me, when I grew up on a farm, I was kind of the one in charge of, even as a young kid, burying all the dead animals, as morbid as that sounds. But for me, it was kind of like, that was my closure. When something died, I'd go out, dig the hole, we'd bury it, you know, I'd put little graves up and everything. So it's always been kind of my MO when a pet dies. So I definitely think I want to bury her. And the other thing is, I have an old cigar box that my first year's teaching, some kids asked me about the tarantula. I told me I had a bunch of snakes and a tarantula, and they wanted to see it. And I talked about the molt. So I brought her molt into school in an old cigar box, and I've carried it around for a while. It's in the garage right now. So I think what I'm going to do is use it as a makeshift coffin. And we have a little flower bed in the front of the new house. We're going to bury her in there. I think that'd be the most appropriate way to go. But again, not seeing this to be all of the downer. It was sad seeing her, but I'm sitting right now in a room in a brand new house, much larger house than we had. And a lot of that, a lot of the reasons it wasn't a joke. A lot of the reasons we talk about the fact that it was time to move was the fact that the Tom's Big Spider stuff with, the size of my tarantula room was limited and we needed more room. And obviously we were talking about getting a bigger house, but that was the big push, was because of the tarantula room. And the house we got was because we walked up and found the tarantula room. All because of her. So talk about having, a profound impact on somebody's life. That's, little spider has had a very profound impact on mine. So moving on to the main topic today, we're going to spend some time talking about Pamphibidius species. Billy and I just rehoused my Pamphibidius species, Araña Pollito, or the chicken spider, last weekend. I've got the video all edited up and almost ready to go. I might put it up a little early. I haven't done 2 videos in a week in a while, so it might be fun to get that one up. But it was, oh my God, it was a train wreck, though. We did three spiders. We did the Pink Zebra Beauty, the E. campostratus. We did the Araña Pollito. And we did my Theraphos and I species, Pura female. And I was totally off my game. Normally when we do these videos, we don't have to cut very much. I pride myself on not making a lot of mistakes. Quite frankly, it just makes it a lot easier to edit when I don't have to cut stuff out. And I have a terrible habit of cursing when I screw up badly, which means I have to go through the video and make sure I cut all of that stuff out. We're always keeping it family friendly. It did sneak by one year, several years ago. I muttered something under my breath and it got by, and it was absolutely humiliating. Somebody messaged me up private and said, "Tom, I don't know if you know this or not, but you said this during it." And I was like, "No way." And I went back, and sure enough, if you had the volume up with earphones on, you could hear me mutter under my breath. So anyway, it was a debacle. Like, I just kept messing up and we kept having to redo it. And I think Billy was getting frustrated at me at one point because then I got silly. So anyway, we did the Pamphibidius, and what kicked it all off is I was having the worst time saying Aranha Pollito. I don't know why. I normally don't have, I mean, I'm obviously not speaking Spanish beautifully, but I, you know, worked in a school district for years where the majority of our students spoke Spanish as, you know, a first or second language. I got comfortable with it, but it was just killing me. I felt like an idiot, and I have, you know, buddies out there that speak Spanish. I was afraid they were going to hear me and make fun of me. So I think I got nervous, and then I just kept screwing it up, and then I was so super self-conscious about it that it kind of flowed through all the rest of the videos. So I almost posted it up kind of as a joke, but I don't want to see people. I don't want people to see me losing it when I mess up all the time. But anyway, back to the topic at hand. During the video, I just kind of went into basic Pamphibidius husbandry. Now, I have three Pamphibidius species right now. I have Pamphibidius species Duran, I have Pamphibidius antinus, and I have Pamphibidius species Aranha Pollito. And they're all, I would keep them all the same. I will get some more Pamphos in the future. I tend to get a hard time from Pampho lovers because Pamphos are one of those spiders that everybody loves. Like, and I love them as well. I just want to make this very clear. But there was a point when I first got serious and, you know, started picking up the larger tropical spiders. When I was looking at the big ones, you know, I was ready to pick up my game a little bit. And I remember the prices for the Pamphibidius species were through the roof. And not only that, but it seemed like every time you turned around, somebody was selling a different locality of a Pamphibidius. It was Pamphibidius species this, Pamphibidius species that. I was having a hard time keeping track of which ones were out there. So I remember getting my Formictopus, and I think what happened was I steered toward Formictopus and was picking up a bunch of Formictopus species and kind of steered away from Pamphos for a while. Now, that's not to mean that eventually we won't get back to Pamphos. It's going to happen. It's a matter of time. I love my large tropical ones. It's just, you can only keep so much. And with Formictopus, for me, it's not only been about keeping, you know, some Formictopus, it's about keeping all of the Formictopus species. I'm obsessive with trying to pick up every single species that's available. So now my attention has been diverted a bit by the Zanestis species. Billy picked me up, obviously, I think it was last year for my birthday, my first one, my Amanus. And then I've since then tried to pick up all of them. There's another one I've just been enamored with. And then I have Theraphosa, which I love. And then there's Sericopelma, which I think are horribly, criminally underrated that I'd like to get, and Pamphos. So we have a ways to go, and I will be picking up more Pamphos. But I figured I'd go through how I keep them, because I get a lot of questions about Pamphos, and it's usually, can you tell me how to keep Pamphibidius species, and then they throw out one of the localities, and they're all pretty much the same. So to kick it off, for slings, they do start off as larger slings, so you do want to make sure that you use something for a sling enclosure that's going to give them a little bit of room to grow. The Jamie's enclosures can work. I used those originally for my Pamphibidius species Durans. They were probably an inch when I got them or so. They were the larger, beefier slings than some of the other species I've kept. And if I were to do it again, it would probably go into something around a 16-ounce deli cup size. That would give them some good, you know, good floor space with depth, because they are going to burrow. I get a lot of folks that pick up the Pamphibidius species slings, and they say, "I just got a Pampho, and it buried itself, and is this right? I thought they were supposed to be a terrestrial species." As with most slings, the Pamphibidius species will burrow, and they actually will keep the burrowing up for quite a while. My Pamphibidius antinus burrowed until it was about 5.5 inches or so. My Pamphibidius species Duran continued to burrow until, again, around the 5.5 inches or so. And then my Pamphibidius species Aranha Pollito was burrowing. Actually, she'd probably burrow now if I let her. I mean, she's in the enclosure. I'll get into this in a minute, where she's got a little pre-made burrow with cork bark hide. but she hasn't done any digging yet. But in the other enclosure, she stayed hidden until most recently, and she's about 7 inches now. So these are guys that will do some burrowing, and I have had other folks tell me that when they got adults and gave the adult females enough room to burrow, they did do some burrowing, even at that large size. So just something to think about when you're setting them up. But slings, again, if you're going to go something, you know, obviously an AMAC box, you're going to go moist substrate. I like to throw in the sphagnum moss. It holds moisture well. It's a nice, what I like about the sphagnum moss too is strategically, when you have smaller sling enclosures, it can be sometimes very difficult to add moisture without flooding things, because you're trying to get, if you're using a pipette or a syringe, you're trying to squirt that water in there to keep the bottom layers moist, and sometimes it doesn't absorb right away, so you get the puddling up top, or it doesn't go where you want to. What I love about the sphagnum moss, and the little tip or trick that I've been using lately, especially with the dram vials, when you use those or the smaller ones, I cut up some of the sphagnum moss and I mix it down the side with the dirt. So in other words, if I'm looking at, say, a little dram vial and it's got dirt in it, you'll see some sphagnum running from the top of it down kind of to the bottom, a strand of it or some pieces of it. And what happens is that absorbs water much more easily than the surrounding dirt. So when I take my little pipette, I hit that and that sucks it right up, holds some water in there. I love that. It's a nice little trick. It's worked well, because I've always had some frustration with, especially when the stuff gets really packed down, the water sometimes won't percolate down into it the way you'd want to. So a little trick there, I've used that. But anyway, with the Pamphibidia species, you definitely want to put some sphagnum in. If you're using a 16-ounce deli cup, then it probably makes sense to put in a little cork bark hide. And what I like to do is kind of bury the cork bark a bit, and then take the back of a, you know, either a pencil or the back of a paintbrush and make a little starter hole in there. If the hole is too big, just a heads up, and I've had people send me pictures, and it's a common mistake, and I've made it as well. With spiders, you may make like a little hide that you think is great for them, but if that hide is too big for them and feels too open and they feel too exposed in it, they just totally shun it. They won't use it. So for example, I'll have people that will have like a little 2-inch sling and they put like half of a plastic cup in there for a hide. That's way too big for them. They're not going to register that as being a tight, cozy, safe place. So you want to make sure that if you use something bigger, try to stuff some dirt in it. Try to, again, you can use sphagnum moss. I've used sphagnum moss, stuffed sphagnum moss in it, made a little hole. And they'll go in, the sphagnum moss will start digging, kind of fill it all up themselves. But when you're putting in something that you expect the spider to use for a hide, you want to make sure that it is the appropriate size for the spider and is kind of tight. You want them to be able to go in there and kind of make it their own and dig a little bit and make sure they feel safe right off the bat, or else they'll just completely ignore it. So if you're setting them up in the 16-ounce, again, sphagnum moss, I'd put in a little cork bark hide, a little hole in there, expect them to dig and just bury the whole thing anyway, and then a water dish. There's been some discussion over the years. I think a lot of people, once they get older, they are a lot less moisture dependent than the slings. So you'll hear a lot of people that keep their larger pamphos on dry substrate with a water dish, which works for some people. And I, full disclosure, my older specimens, I usually keep partially moist. I will let it dry out. I do give them large water dishes, so they always have moisture. My Pamphibidius antinus right now has a water dish that's probably about 5.5 inches in diameter or so. So if it dries out a little bit, it's totally fine. She's got the water dish. If I saw her hanging around the water dish, then I would be more inclined to keep things moister. But as far as the adults, they are very hardy. They can do well on a dry substrate as long as you keep a water dish in there. I just like to make it rain every once in a while and give them that option. So slings, great eaters. They all start off with those little Christmas tree patterns on their abdomens, which are absolutely adorable. And they will take down prey items just about as big as them. They're one of the hard, heavy-hitting spiders. Those tropical species generally are voracious eaters, and you don't have to worry about doing the whole pre-killed thing, because if you have something even close to appropriate size for them, they will take it down. As far as what to feed them, a lot of questions lately about, is it bad to feed them crickets? Is it bad to feed? I guess somebody out there did a video saying crickets are terrible to feed them or whatever, because I've been getting a lot of people commenting and going, what do I do? I can't feed them crickets. I was told they hurt things and they can kill the spiders or whatever. I don't know what misinformation is out there, but you can use crickets, you can use roaches, you can use mealworms, whatever you want. I like to mix things up a little bit. I use crickets as my base only because I'm really fast when feeding with crickets. I'm able to grab up with my tongs very quickly. where the roaches I have to kind of chase around, and they're very good at, you know, slipping one way or the other when you're trying to grab them with the tongs. The crickets, I can just bounce around there, grab a couple of them really quick, throw them in, and move on. So it makes feeding time go more quickly. But that's the only reason it's easier for me. I do have three roach colonies. I do break out roaches every once in a while. I do break out mealworms every once in a while and superworms every once in a while. So I do try to give mine a variety, but you can feed them the same stuff. There's no scientific data out there that says that feeding them crickets is going to kill them or that feeding them just roaches is going to harm them. So feel free to use what's convenient for you. Sometimes it's easier to get crickets. Sometimes it's easier to get roaches. Sometimes it's easier to just, if you have a few spiders, to have the mealworms in the refrigerator and taking them out and feed them and holding on to the rest so you always have something to feed your spiders. So whatever works for you as far as feeding. As far as how often to feed, I usually feed my slings twice a week when I can. However, I should add a caveat to that. If I feed them a particularly large meal, so for example, if I have a 1-inch sling and I drop in a rather large cricket and it's eating that cricket several hours later, I won't feed it again that week. I will give it a week or so, maybe even more, because if they have larger meals, they can fill up quite quickly, especially slings. And that's something a lot of people don't realize, is that it's very possible for a sling to feed once and fill completely up. I have these tiny Pseudohapalopus species Columbia slings. I have the video of them. I think I got them about a year ago. Somebody told me they grow very fast, very quickly. They're not growing very quickly, but it's fine. But they were super tiny, under a quarter inch. I mean, oh gosh, probably an eighth of an inch or so. I could barely see them. I could literally, they made my eyes hurt trying to focus on them. And I was feeding, I feed them pre-kill prey. Well, what'll happen is I'll drop in like a little chunk of, say, a cricket leg. That thing will be on the cricket leg for a few hours. It's completely filled up. That's it. It's done eating. So just know that's possible. Although Pamphibidius, they're kind of piggies. They're known for eating to the point where they get quite engorged and quite fat and rotund. So you probably won't experience that with the slings, but I just want to give people a heads up that that is a thing. So expect fast growth with these guys. I did the list of the fastest growing tarantula species, and this is one of the reasons I hate doing lists, because I traditionally, there's always been something I leave off the list. It's like years ago, I did a list of my top favorite New World species, and I had the GBB, the C. kinopubescens section all edited out, ready to go, and somehow when I assembled it, I completely forgot to add it. So I've always done this. One of the reasons I steer away from the list, because I always goof them up, but I forgot to include a Pamphibidia species, which was kind of criminal. So when I do the video version, we'll add that. They are very fast growing. They are one of the species that people report that they have slings that can get up to 3 or 4 inches easily in the first year, and I would call that pretty good growth rate. If you start with a tiny sling, and by the end of the first year, you have a big hairy spider, you're doing pretty well for yourself. So slings, awesome eaters, fast growers, very, very skittish. That's something we should mention. Very fast, very skittish. A lot of the tropical species are very fast and skittish. You know, I'm looking at the Formictopus, the Zanesta species have been bonkers. My Sericopelma species was quite skittish early on. Something to recognize, because we talk a lot about the old world species being very fast, but I've noticed the new world species can boogie when they want to as well. So something to have a heads up on. Now, as far as juvenile stage, we'll say anywhere from 2 to 3.5 inches or so. The juvenile is a very arbitrary term. Like, it doesn't, everybody has a different description. I usually like to think it's, for the majority of species, it's when they start showing some of their adult colors. However, that can be difficult with the Pamphibidius, because I've had them go like start showing their adult colors and be black. And then a couple molts later, they're back to brown and then back to black again. They seem to bounce back and forth. Same thing with Formictopus. I've had them bounce back and forth as far as the colorations. But it's when they're starting to look like hairy spiders. And in the case of Pamphibidius, because it's a larger species, would say around 2.5, 3, 3.5 inches or so would be around the juvenile size. For this, you want something. Again, keeping in mind they're going to want to do some burrowing, keeping in mind that they are larger spiders and are going to grow rather quickly, you want to make sure you give them plenty of space. So something around, I would say, 2 gallons or so, 8 quarts. Probably around 8 liters, I guess, would be the metric version of it. Hopefully I'm in the ballpark. I'm trying to learn the conversions in my head, so these are a little quicker, because you usually have to look all these up. But a decent size enclosure that offers some depth. I would not put them in something shallow. I've seen people that take them out and put them in the shallower enclosures. Again, we've already established that most of them will appreciate the ability to be able to burrow some more. You also want to keep some moist substrate in there, and it makes it easier to keep it moist. It means you don't have to add water as much if you give yourself some more dirt to work with. And I'd like to give them 3 or 4 inches or so, allow them to dig. My P. Antonis dug, I had her originally in a medium-sized critter keeper, which worked out really well. I did cover up some of the extra vent on the top, but left all the vents around the sides of the top. So just to keep it from evaporating too quickly, she had a cork bark hide, the old water dish, the sphagnum moss, you know, the old routine. And she dug right down the bottom, had quite an extensive burrow. At one point, I thought she was going to surface. She molted, came back up, and she was kind of out and about a little bit. And then she went and burrowed down the other side and did it again. Now she's out in the open, but I will say the last enclosure I had her in didn't really permit for burrowing, but she did use her hide all of the time. Now, if you're looking at, you know, a 2.5-inch, 3-inch spider, know that at this point you can feed them large crickets. They'll take down no problem. Large Belats, mealworms, superworms, whatever it may be, they're going to take down bigger prey items, and you may even find you want to feed them more than once. Now, again, as mentioned earlier, this is a species that will eat until it's very, very, very plump. I remember back in the day, people were talking about, there was this like urban legend around them that they would eat until they would actually, their abdomens would explode, which I found to be kind of silly. If the spider is not given a ridiculous amount of height to be able to climb and possibly fall and rupture its abdomen, it shouldn't spontaneously explode. I've actually heard that one very recently where somebody said they were trying to not feed their Pamphibidia so much because they don't want its abdomen to explode. I don't know where that came from. That's not going to happen, but it can, keep in mind, though it's not going to spontaneously explode, a very fat spider is more at risk for some type of damage or injury that causes its abdomen to burst. So that's something that should be said. But they got this reputation, I think, because many people have reported theirs would eat right up until the point where they molted. I've honestly not experienced this with any of the three that I keep. They usually do stop eating when they go into pre-molt, and they disappear for a little while, and then they come out after they molt and start eating again. So I really wouldn't worry about all that. But I do feed my juveniles once a week, again, one or two large crickets or so, which they take down with gusto. It's a lot of fun to watch them hunt. I love the big leggy tropical species, really chase down that prey with intensity. And again, if you want to feed them less, that's totally okay. With feeding schedules, there's no real right or wrong feeding schedule. I get a lot of folks that ask, what is the correct feeding schedule for a tarantula? There's no correct one. In the wild, they wouldn't eat nearly as much. They're opportunistic hunters. They probably wouldn't, you know, I've had people that work out in the wild, scientists, mention the fact that the ones we have in the hobby always seem much more, for lack of a better term, obese compared to the specimens they find outside. And that's because they're dealing with weather. They might not be able to find prey as readily as they do when they have a keeper throwing stuff into them weekly or biweekly. So again, don't fret over. I like to check mine more often. I have a larger collection. It behooves me to go around and check them at least once a week because I can open up the enclosure, make sure the spider's okay, take out boluses, clean water dishes, make sure water dishes are full, and then feed them. But for some people, just feeding them every 2 weeks is fine. Some people drop in a big roach or something and they feed them once a month. Totally okay. Just make sure you check on them in between. Now, for adults, not a whole heck of a lot out there for adult enclosures, you know, professional stuff for large spiders. That's a problem that I think many of us have run into in the hobby, at least in the U.S. Maybe it's a little different overseas in some other nations. But here, it's like we don't have many choices once they get, you know, if you get a big 7-8-inch spider and Pamphibidius can get 8 inches or more, then it's tough sometimes finding enclosures for them. I was using Ziploc containers that were about 2.5 feet by maybe 14 inches, 15 inches, and then about 6 inches deep, which worked pretty well, except I couldn't fit enough substrate in for my taste. It allowed me about 2 inches of substrate, which really wasn't as much as I wanted to include. I tried to get, you know, creative with it with the cork bark hide. The side that the cork bark hide was on, I poured more substrate in, so it kind of went over the top of the cork bark and gave it a little more depth, but it really couldn't burrow the way I would have liked it to. Not at that point, it hadn't been burrowing much. When I took it out of the Critter Keeper, I'm talking about my Pantanus, when I took it out of the Crypt Keeper, it was hanging out in the top more often. It filled in its burrow, so it wasn't burrowing anymore, so I figured this would be okay, but I still like to give them a decent amount of substrate just in case. I did just move mine into some of the primal cages, and they are 16 long by 12 wide by 10 inches deep, I believe. And it's a decent amount of floor space. It's a decent amount of depth, so I can put 4 or 5 inches of substrate in it. And that's what we ended up putting my Araña Polito into. And it seems to be, she has enough room right now. We'll see what happens. If she hits the 8-inch mark, we'll see how it looks. But so far, so good. I may put my Antinus into one as well, because she's right now in these kind of flimsy, I like them. They're clear. but they're a little flimsy. They're about 7 inches deep by 14 by 16 inches or so. So again, decent amount of floor space, but and allowed me to put enough substrate in that she could do a little burrowing if she wanted to, but they're a little too flimsy for my taste. So I don't think I want to put something that big in it. So she may be getting one of those as well. Also, you can buy one of the big acrylic enclosures. They have the 10-gallon ones from Lorax Plastics. But heads up, I hopped over to the site last week because I wanted to get some more enclosures over their eBay page, and all their items are taken down. Now, I do remember talking to the guy that runs the place, that owns the place, that they only do it seasonally when they have a lot of other work to do. They don't do the cages as much, so I don't know what happened there. Maybe they're just busy and they don't have time to do the cages, but they're not up right now, which is a bummer because I had a bunch of stuff I wanted to order. I do like their stuff, and their 10 gallons are definitely big enough for larger spiders, the 8-inch spiders. And again, when setting them up, I would start them with moist substrate. I would let it dry out, but I would start with deep moist substrate. The cork bark hide, again, give them a nice little space to dig in, hide in. I have found that mine will retreat to the burrows. I went to check on my Pamphibidia species Duran before we started this, and she has actually stacked up a bunch of dirt over her hide, and she was hiding in there. So she's still using her hide, and she's probably about 7.5 inches now or so. So give them a hide, give them a place to go. Again, depth if you can. A nice big water dish is always prudent. I always like giving big water dishes, especially if you're going to let things dry out in between, make sure that they have access to water. And then I do make it rain in mine every once in a while. You know, every couple months or so, I will go in and do some water in there, especially in the wintertime when the air gets particularly dry, when the heat's running. I will go in and moisten things down, but I will let it dry out in between. And they're voracious eaters. Mine will easily eat 4 or 5 crickets a pop. You could use big roaches, hissers. Dubia would work fine. A couple super worms, again, take your pick, but there's never been a problem with any of mine eating. It's one of the fun things about keeping those species is that they're voracious eaters, especially if you're keeping some of the other species, like the quote-unquote beginner species. Some of those slow-growing ones can have moments where they don't eat. These guys are always eating. Now, as far as temperatures are concerned, back when I was first scoping out Pamphibidia species, I ignored them for a little while because all of what I read said that they were very moisture dependent and that they needed high temperatures. Now, we've already kind of taken the moisture dependency part out of it. Yes, moisture dependent as slings, a little less so as juveniles, and some folks keep them dry with water dishes as adults. I still get mine a little moisture, so not really a species that you have to go nuts with it for. They're very adaptable. However, as far as the temperatures are concerned, again, no issue there. When I first got my Antinous, it was when before I heated my tarantula room. So in the wintertime, it would dip down into the high 60s, sometimes 67, 66 degrees, not for long stretches of time, but we'd get some days where it'd be in the 60s. And then, you know, low 70s or so. Summertime, it would be in the mid 70s to upper 70s, even to 80, 82 on occasion. Nowadays, it's about 72 here on the lower shelves, about 74 on the higher shelves. So it doesn't go much below that. But do know I have raised them. Oh, this Pamphibidia species Duran was also, I picked those up when they were slings, and that was also when the tarantula room was much cooler, and they did perfectly fine. So don't worry about having extra heat. Don't add extra heat. If your house room temperature is in high 60s in the wintertime to low 70s, you'd be perfectly fine with these guys. So that's what I've got for Pamphibidia species. Again, now that I'm talking about these, I was looking at some the other day, and I definitely need to pick up some more. People get angry. It's funny because everybody's got their genus of tarantula they love, and when you get into the larger species, the tropical species, the big ones, everybody's got, I love Theraphosa species, I love Formictopus species, I love Pamphibidia species, I love Zanesta species. And it's like they get upset when you don't share the same love for them. Or more, I should say, they perceive that you don't share the same love for them. So I've had many people on my Formictopus videos go, well, why don't you keep Pamphibidius? Why don't you like Pamphibidius? And it's like, just because I love this genus doesn't mean that I don't like this other one. So that's the way it is with the Pamphos. It's just I got heavy into Formictopus. I do have Pamphos. I love my Pamphos. I love the ones I have. I will eventually get more. There are some I want. But my Formictopus is just what's that became the ones that I decided to collect it at that particular time. So awesome spiders. Definitely should have been on the list of fastest growing ones. Look out for the when I do the video. I'm working on the video version for that now. I'm getting some footage. There will be some type of Pamphibidius, probably Pamphibidius Antinous, because that's the one that's my oldest, and she's about 8 inches now. So look good when you're talking about big spiders on a video. But I'll definitely be adding those to the list because that was an error. So before we close this one out, I did have somebody ask if I could address again how I keep slings in the wintertime. I brought up before that I have this thing I call the nursery, which is just some dumb word I came up for it, but One of the things I found is that when keeping slings in the dram vials or the 5 ounce deli cups is the fact that you can moisten down that substrate, but they can evaporate very, very quickly. That moisture can be sucked right out of there during the wintertime when the furnace or heat is running and the air is really dry. And that can be deadly for slings. That's probably the number one. I would venture to say that that is probably the number one killer of slings. When I talk to people about slings and they send pictures, it's that the substrate dries out and the slings, because they don't have that waxy coating on their cuticle yet to protect them from drying out, they basically dehydrate and curl up. And that can be a huge issue for slings, especially during the wintertime. So somebody asked you, like, didn't you build some type of thing with heat and everything? Let me just make it very clear. I do not add extra heat to my slings or my nursery. It's not about that. It's just about making sure that the moisture doesn't evaporate out of it too quickly. So what I will do is get a larger plastic container. Right now I'm using these ones I got from, I believe it was Target. It doesn't really matter the type of, I've used different things over the course of the years, but you want something that's got some space in it. And what I do is line it with paper towels on the bottom, and I carefully place all my little sling enclosures. So if they're in little dram vials, most of mine are in little dram vials, the Jamie's enclosures, or some of them are in the 5 ounce deli cups, and I stack those all inside this. Now, also, I ventilate it. I want to make that clear. You go, you put your ventilation. Usually, what I use is an older enclosure for tarantulas that I'm not currently using for a larger tarantula. So, for example, I've used the Sterilite boxes before, but I make sure there's got to be good ventilation around all four sides. You don't have to go crazy with it, but there should be some nice cross ventilation in it. Then I put the paper towels down. I put all of the little enclosures inside there. And then I will do is put an open container of water like right in the middle of it. And occasionally I will even spray down the paper towels inside. So if it's a really, you know, really particularly dry day, like the other day it hit like 8 on the humidity in this room because it was so dry, then you can sit there and squirt a little water on the paper towels, keep the paper towels moist. You put that water in the middle, and you can find something. What I've used is deli cups before with the cups that I've poked holes in the top of the cup, so it's not just a big open container of water, because what will happen is you'll pick up that container, you'll forget that it's in there, and it'll spill all over the place. But again, that's what the paper towels are for. And what that does is allow for, so even if the outside room where those slings are, the room that they're in, dries out quite a bit, the humidity goes way down because the heat's running, the inside of that container will actually help prevent, because it's a little bit moister than the outside, will prevent those enclosures from drying out too quickly. And I've used it for quite a few years now. I basically started using it years ago before I had the humidifier in my tarantula room. Billy had picked up a bunch of slings for me before, you know, it was right around Christmas time or so. So it was cold, it was really cold out. The heat was kicking on, things were drying out, and I was noticing that the little sling cages were drying out much, much more quickly than some of my larger enclosures. Again, it's one of the reasons when you have a fossorial species or a moisture-dependent species, you want to give them more substrate because it takes longer for the moisture to evaporate completely out of it. If you give them a couple inches, that evaporates very quickly. If you give them 4 or 5 inches, it takes a while for those lower levels to evaporate. So when you have those little dram vials, again, you want to put in enough holes in the top so that they've obviously got some transfer of, you know, air flow through them. It's not going to be like good cross ventilation like we talk about, but you want to make sure that those containers breathe. But unfortunately, not only if they can breathe, then that moisture can be sucked out. So when you put that container of water in there with the paper towels around, mist down the paper towels, stick it on a shelf, I'll tell you, it keeps them from drying out a lot faster. It's kind of like a little, I see it as a little safety net. Like, obviously I'm in there, I'm feeding them twice a week anyway, I'm checking on them, I can add moisture, but I've just found that you don't have to add moisture to it. You don't have to get the little pipettes out nearly as much when you keep them like this, and you can kind of have the peace of mind that even if you have a really cold night, like the other night, we hit, I think, 3 degrees here, the heat was running constantly, the air dried out, I know that all my teeny tiny slings are going to be safe. There's not going to be a situation where it dries out overnight and I come in the morning and have a bunch of dead slings. So to clarify, there is no, it's not an incubator. There is no extra heat source. That defeats the purpose. If I put a heat source in there, then I would have a super humid inside. You know, it'd be really humid with that extra, you know, dish of water in the middle of it. And adding more heat would just make it so it would evaporate even more quickly, which undermines the whole point of it. The idea is just to make sure that you protect them from evaporating too quickly. Again, the inside won't be quote unquote humid. I don't measure the humidity. It's just that extra water as that evaporates goes into that container, keeps the overall humidity inside the container up, which keeps those containers, the little teeny containers, from evaporating as fast. So hopefully that explains. It seems like a long drawn out idea. It's basically plastic box with holes in the side, paper towels on the bottom, put a little container with some water in it, put your slings around it, put the cap back on, stick it on a shelf. There you go. Simple as anything. It does help. I've, you know, done little experiments with it where we took like six little dram vials, put the same substrate in each, poured some water in it so you could see the little line where the moist substrate was, and we put some of them in my little sling thing. We put some of them on a shelf right next to it. The ones on the shelf that weren't in the little sling container I made, the little nursery, dried out much more quickly than the other ones. So there you go. So a little tip for those that need it or want it. Again, if you run a humidifier in your room, and I have run a humidifier before, that also helps. But it just, again, it's just about giving you extra peace of mind when things get really cold and dry. And, you know, right now it's the point where everything in the house, if you bump up against something, the static is ridiculous because everything's so dry. That's not a good environment for most spiders or slings. And with the other spiders, you can really, you know, larger containers, it's easier with large water dishes and deeper substrate to keep them from drying out. Slings can be a little trickier. So that should do it for this one. Apologize for being a little more low-key this morning. I started this one at 7 o'clock in the morning before I had my coffee. The fact that I was able to get through this podcast, like, I'm kind of proud of myself. I'm not going to lie. I just texted Billy because she wasn't up yet, and I came up here and started doing the podcast. And I'm like, yeah, man, I can't wait to get a coffee in me. So I'm going to retreat downstairs in a moment and partake in my morning coffee, which I desperately need. But as always, thanks so much for listening. You can find me on tomsbigspiders.com, the website. You can find me on Tom's Big Spiders, the YouTube channel, for those of you interested in seeing what I think to be is an araña pollito. And I say I think because who knows what I really got. I forgot to put this little disclaimer in the beginning, but there's been many Pamphibidia species that have been labeled araña pollito, or people have sold different species as araña pollito, and they're not the real species. Nobody's quite sure. It's kind of all very confusing and a bit of a mess, but it's what it was sold as. It was what it was labeled as. A lot of people think that they could be just regular Pamphibidius antinus or a type of variant of Pamphibidius antinus. That could actually be the case. It could just be a different type of it's just a mess. So full disclaimer, we're calling it araña pollito. That's what it was sold as. Until I know otherwise, that's what I will label as. But I do always add that little disclaimer that I'm not quite sure what I have. You know, it could just be a regular old normal P. antinus, who knows. But anyway, that will do it for this one. Hope everybody stays safe, and we'll catch you all next time.